This is a difficult year. This is probably our most difficult year, just in the sense of the depth in which we've created. We're proud of that. There are going to be some good players that we're going to have to release, but I'm sure some of those players are going to get claimed or go on to other teams and have, you know, successful careers. But you know, we're probably in the healthiest position we've been in since we've gotten here.
That's Bears Assistant General Manager Ian Cunningham on GN Sports with Caitlin Sharkey.
The Butcher!
That has been the watchword of this front office. We're going to have to cut some good players from this roster. This team's going to be hard to make. It has been a common refrain about this year is different. The quality of this roster is so improved.
I agree with Ian Cunningham and Ryan Poles. The roster is improved. It is better, especially when you start looking at the skill positions on offense. You go, DeAndre Swift is an upgrade over what they've had. The wide receiver position, clearly, you pay DJ Moore, you bring in Keenan Allen, you draft Rome Odunze. Great. The talent on the defense is really strong. Montez Sweat is good. Their linebackers are solid. Their back five is terrific. But in the positions where they don't have great players, and as of now, the only great player on the defensive line is Montez Sweat. I'm not even sure if they have a good player on the defensive line that isn't named Montez Sweat. So yesterday on football night, Ken Davis and Josh Schrock were a couple of my guests on the show, and Schrock said this about the depth at defensive line in the roster overall.
I mean, I think what you take away is when Ryan Poole said at the start of camp that he was going to get a full evaluation of the defensive line, he didn't exactly like what he saw. And I think we probably knew that going in. Darrell Taylor, I like it as a pickup, but they're just trying to create, you know, it's like the Moneyball meme, right? We're going to try to create another edge rusher in the aggregate. Like, can we get 10 sacks out of Taylor, Walker, Robinson, Booker combined? I don't know. Chris Williams is just a guy. That's a Zach Pickens is hurt, and we cannot wear Andrew Billings down. They're going to do it anyways. But if Andrew Billings or Jervon Dexter gets hurt at any point this season, this paper-thin defense kind of collapses on itself.
Ooh. Paper-thin defense. I wish I had a paper-thin defense and I could win a Super Bowl too. It is not. It's not good. That's not good because they will get hurt. They do get hurt.
Yes.
And I thought the goal was, as I understood it, that with the rotation that's played, as we talked about yesterday, with snap percentages in general are down for individual offensive linemen, and your depth isn't just because of injury. Your depth isn't just next man up.
That doesn't mean it's quality depth.
But your depth plays every game. With rotations, especially when the weather's warmer, especially early in a season, you're going to have a lot of guys at that position, at that front seven.
And they played Montez Sweat with 78% of the snaps.
That's all. But that's common.
That's a lot.
It's common. But you're going to have guys active who are going to play and matter throughout a game. It isn't just if this guy gets hurt.
Studs, let me ask you, how do you feel about the depth on the Bears' defensive line?
Depth? Nah, it's not great on depth. I like the top. I like the top of the defensive line. I feel better about the defense.
I feel,
I'm a Jervon Dexter guy, well established. Andrew Billings is good. I think we can put Andrew Billings in the good category.
Okay, that's fair.
But I do agree, though, that Jervon Dexter needs to prove himself. So there's that. I'm just a believer. It's my guy. I feel better about the defensive end depth after the adding of Darrell Taylor than I did before, but it's still not great. I also understand that it's the roster as a whole is still a work in progress. Like, this is not a finished team, which is why when we have this conversation, it's a valid conversation to have because it's a mitigating factor for their season. But I've understood for a while that this is still a roster that's in progress, and this is not a Super Bowl roster yet. If it was, then we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Okay, so my feelings about the defensive line have been pretty well established, but if you are new to the show, as good as I think the Bears linebackers and back five are, and I think they're really good, it would help them be even better if there was a consistent pass rush. And even with Montez Sweat, we saw that Matt Eberflus had to do some stuff. He had to send the linebackers and send the safeties and send Kyler Gordon, who is an outstanding blitzer. He's such a fun blitzer to watch.
Great timing.
It would be nice if those guys didn't have to do that and we could see everyone's numbers of taking the ball away go up because there's pressure on the quarterback and the ball having to come out. That's just one part of this. The scarier part is if I go, hey, Dan, how do you feel about the depth on the Bears' offensive line?
Not great. You're down your starting center. I don't know if I can trust the right guard. And you've got a left guard who is never healthy. Has got a history of getting hurt all the time.
And a left tackle that's just kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
He's there, and he is there pretty much every week.
But
he's
that's
just
okay,
kind
though.
Of there.
There's value in being there all the time.
And at Farm and Fleet.
That's refined value.
Yeah, because they it's there. That value is there.
Let me get you updated on some of the Bears' roster moves. The latest we have, this is from Brad Biggs' Twitter. The Bears are waiving tight end Steven Carlson. He is a likely candidate to be re-signed to the practice squad. And veteran safety Adrian Colbert will be released. And offensive lineman Aviante Collins has been placed on waivers.
So there's another conversation from yesterday that I want to go back to for a second. And this was our conversation with Dan Wiederer, and it blends, I think, really well with what Schrock had to say about the roster. This is Wiederer talking when you asked him about Patrick Scales.
One of the four on my list, Dan, that I can't get clarity in terms of what the state of their health is. Patrick Scales is one of them. Bates is one we talked about a couple minutes ago. Pickens is a little bit out there. And then Kevin Byard, who's never missed a game in his NFL career and is suddenly missing from practice for a few days in a row. You go, okay, I assume that he's going to be ready for week one. But you know my rule, until I see it with my own eyes on a practice field several days in a row, I never take the word of the people that stand up at the podium on that stuff. And so I don't know. They keep telling us that Scales will be okay. I don't know. I can't tell you yet if that's the case. And if not, then you go into the regular season having to troubleshoot a little bit.
And it looks like they're at that point from what Biggsy reported earlier today, that you could be missing that guy for the first 4 weeks of the season. So I get it. It's there's still plenty of time. There's still, what, 12 days until a game for the Bears to get guys healthy and ready to go. But I do think that if you add in the moves that were made starting Friday afternoon to the injuries that have plagued the Bears throughout camp, and now some of these that seem like a little bit more acute at the end, the roster doesn't feel as stable as it did before. It's possible, and maybe even probable, when you look at some of the offensive weapons that the Bears have, that they're able to overcome some of that if Caleb is as good as people hope, as quickly as people hope he's good. But the idea of protecting him is significant. How often throughout January, February, March, April, were we talking about the Bears' center position?
I adopted the cause after watching last year's playoffs and watching the difference it makes to have somebody who execute some of those multi-gap block responsibilities at a high level, especially those who can operate at multiple levels of the defense. It isn't just I can get a guy, I can chip a guy over here, I can reach to a guy over here. It's I can now I'm at the linebacker level. Those guys are special. And I don't know that the Bears need special, but I was on it through the draft with all the names that were possible. And Olin Krutz has said the Bears have never allotted adequate money, resources, development, or care at the position. We went through it with, you know, this with Sam Mustipher and how and Max Rustipher, and as good as he was at getting people aligned and as smart as he was, too often overpowered. I said, well, let's get a guy who isn't overpowered and is that smart. That'd be great.
Yeah.
I know they're expensive.
Here we are.
And here we are. They bring in Ryan Bates, who's a guy.
They love him, though. They really love Ryan Bates.
They almost got in trouble trying to sign him the last time. I know they love him, but he's older now, and he's a guy, and so is Coleman Shelton.
Maybe we're making too much of this, but I do think it's valuable for the quarterback and the center, especially a young quarterback. Like, this isn't Matthew Stafford. A young quarterback needs a center that's going to help him. And they need continuity as much as the guys need to be in the Rockettes up front. The quarterback and the center have got to be on the same page too. There's a lot of stuff that Caleb is doing for the first time, with him reciting the play calls in the huddle, him taking snaps from under center. There's a lot there. And you're already doing a bit of a scramble. Now, I still hold the theory of Nate Davis doesn't like training camp. Like, I believe that now. I think we've got 2 years of evidence here, and there'll be people in Nashville that'll tell you the same thing.
But Lawrence, he told reporters that he couldn't have gotten to this point without practice.
Well, he didn't say without training camp.
You're right.
I think that he's just one of those guys. It's like, this is...
You're right.
I'll be ready when September 8th comes. I'll be ready. And he's got a history of that. He's got a history of, he's fine once the season starts.
So wake me up when training
but
camp.
But it doesn't seem to fit.
Practice, man.
The thing that I think is weird about it is that he doesn't seem to fit what they say they want in players.
Now, that's where I am as far as the example that it sets. If he's allowed to do this, why is everybody else abiding by the HITS principle and hustle and intensity and get your track shoes and everything that they do? And yet here was a guy like, nah, I'm good.
But that is a question that I think you can legitimately ask of the Bears front office. There's not supposed to be any problems there. You have two guys who most people think their calling card is finding offensive linemen.
Is that only because they both played offensive line?
Yes.
Because I don't know that it's nothing one equates to the other.
I agree with you, but that's something that has been put on those guys and stuff that they've talked about. So if their offensive line isn't good again, you go, wait, why isn't your offensive line good? I think that is worth talking about. What's wrong with you?
Nothing. I was just talking to Studs about something, and he's mad at a presumption that I would have made. There's a piece of audio that we want that became available, and he goes, Tanny already put it in.
I did not yell like that.
Yeah,
I said,
you did.
No, I quietly said, Tanny already put it in.
You say it quietly?
Well, I don't know how loud I come through to your headphones.
Please. Oh, please. That's like my wife and I would be like, well, I didn't know you had your earbuds in. Or I didn't really yell. I yell now because I presume everybody's got their earbuds in. Don't give me that.
Ray's sitting right next to me.
I know
Ray,
that
did
trick.
I yell? Did I yell, Ray?
That's one of my tricks.
No, that was...
I invented moral fiber.
That was just the regular Studs tone, but in your ear, I could understand you thinking it sounded intense.
I don't know.
You're projecting. I think you're projecting.
I don't know. I don't think I am. I don't think I am. So where were we? Offensive line, defensive line, paper thin roster. Okay. Now let me ask you this. Relative to any other NFL team, and this is sort of a Dusty Baker thing I'm doing here. It's like, it ain't just us. It's everybody, man. And the truth is, maybe it is. Maybe all good teams are, you know, we could always be better, but the salary cap system, The Bears have a uniquely flexible cap situation right now. So there's really no excuse for them like there would be a team after a post-push-in that then needs to cut corners or has to find value, Farm and Fleet, that the Bears aren't in that position. So they really shouldn't have a depth concern at this point, financially, right?
That was the whole point.
Right.
That was the whole point of look at all this cap flexibility the Bears have, and look at all this money that they've saved so that they wouldn't end up, and maybe what we're seeing is them working through some of those problems where it's like, you know what? We have all this draft capital too. Let's trade some of it so that we can get some bodies in here that can help us. But I don't know if that makes anyone feel better about where things stand.
And they've been pretty lucky with injuries so far, for the most part.
Layla talks about this a lot. She talks about the concept of thinking that the quarterback is going to fix everything. And maybe Caleb will. I would just like, and I don't want this to come off as if the Bears haven't done anything. I think the Bears have done as much as they can to help Caleb succeed, except for some personnel stuff. I don't think they were aggressive enough at center in free agency. And that might be because they felt like they knew exactly what they needed and they were going to get it from either Shelton or Bates. I think both of those players are fine. I don't know if any of them, you know, I don't think that either of them were the top, the position. They were in what, the top seven or so at the position that were available. But, okay, so protecting Caleb now, to me, becomes paramount. And on the defensive side, you kind of have everything except a three technique. And I know Studs is high on Jervon Dexter. Pad level is still an issue. When a guy is 6'7" and he's trying to play low man wins, it can be difficult.
I think Studs is high man on Jervon Dexter, too.
You think so?
Yes. I think they're I don't know anybody who likes Jervon Dexter as a player as much as Studs does.
Day they drafted him.
Here's what's weird about the Dexter thing. If it felt like the beginning of camp, people were talking about Jervon Dexter, and then as camp went on, it was just kind of like, everything's fine.
Next up, we're going to talk some baseball with a guy that made a hell of a catch last night.
Hell yeah.
His team scored 18 runs and stole 1,000 bases. I want to talk about that plan against Yasmani Grandal. Wow. Ian Happ.
The talent that's here and the talent that is continuing to develop here. We obviously have some mainstay guys like Ian Happ.
Ian Happ, Cubs all-star outfielder.
Drilled in the air. It's got a chance. Get out the tape measure for Ian Happ. All the way on to Waveland Avenue.
Absolutely crushed that ball.
What I love about Ian is very dedicated and serious about his craft.
Gold Glove Award winner.
Happ turns and goes back near the fence. Happ will slide and makes a great catch. What a play by Ian Happ.
Host of the Compound Podcast.
I got a really nice chirp today from the outfield bleachers. It was like the eighth inning, and the guy just yelled as loud as he could. And I love that. Love to hear it. Dakota's yawning. That's a good start to the episode, man. Awesome, dude. Yeah, happy to be here.
Connect Roasters coffee enthusiast.
Here's a man that probably has 5 fresh pots a day. He's got an insatiable thirst for coffee.
Ian Happ with Bernstein and Holmes on 670 The Score.
We toast you, Ian Happ.
Well, note to self, try not to yawn while on a show with Ian Happ. That was a little bit of the old red ass there popping out, huh? I don't want to see that.
As someone who likes protocol on a radio show and or podcast, I completely agree with
you. Yeah, no, I get it.
Either you want to be here or not.
The Cubs at 66-66. Don't look now, but they've moved into second place in the NL Central and still fighting for the possibility of that playoff spot. Fangraphs gives them a 2.6% chance to do that. And the Cubs will try to prove that wrong or silly. Nice catch last night, Ian. That was a hell of a play.
Thanks. Yeah, that's a tough corner out there. And
in Pittsburgh getting all the way back. I think Mike Jeff probably wasn't very happy with the fence dimensions on that one.
Can you walk us through it?
Yeah, I mean, played there enough that kind of know. I've never had one exactly in the corner. I do very specifically remember a Key Brian Hayes home run that it just scooted over the fence right there. But, you know, you're kind of aware that that corner is out there. I was actually playing a little bit in the gap. And so pre-pitch positioning was pretty good for me to be able to get there. And you're kind of running towards that corner, wondering if the ball is going to stay in. And you have to keep checking the fence, keep checking the fence. So I had two or three peaks on the way over there, one really late. And just had a pretty good beat on it to be able to track it down.
Ian's with us on the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline. Download the Circa Sports app today. Do you have a like your own personal protocol for ball, wall, ball, and how many times, depending on your distance, you allow yourself to look back? Or are you calculating it immediately with the trajectory of the ball, knowing, oh boy, I don't have time, I got to go get this right now, or this one's a little lazier, I can maybe take care of my body a little bit more?
Yeah, you try to get at least one early peak. So ball's hit, kind of judging the first, I don't know, third of the flight as you're headed back, and you try to get a peak as the ball is kind of hitting its apex to just figure out how far you are from the wall, especially when it's a really long run like that. And then that last peak is kind of that's the one that you don't always get. But in a situation like that where the dimensions are a little funky, just getting that last peek in to make sure that you have some space, or even if you don't have space, to figure out exactly where you are. So that last peek is the one that you don't always get, but the, especially with a corner like that, just trying to be aware. I mean, you don't play there all the time. It's a little bit easier at home when you have kind of a sense of where everything is.
Is that in your top three major league catches of your career?
I think situation of the game and just momentum wise and where kind of where we were at, there's definitely some ones that come to mind, but that one, situation of the game, you know, I just tried to make a pretty aggressive play on Triolo and didn't get it done. Jamo gave up a run, so to make that play and keep that from a double or a triple there and get the second out of the inning and put Jamo in a little bit better spot, that felt pretty good.
So what's your favorite?
You know, I had a catch on Goldschmidt in St. Louis in the down the left field line in a big spot in the game that, I don't know, it just sticks out in my head. And then the other one was the Alec Mills no-hitter. And it wasn't like I didn't have to dive or anything, but Alec Mills no-hitter, Jed Jerko hit me a ball. I was playing center field. Jed Jerko hit me a ball to left center pretty deep, and I just made a really good run after that ball. That one sticks out too.
Have you ever heard of Reed Johnson?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Have you ever seen the catch that he made for the Cubs at Washington in 08?
No, I can't. It doesn't pop into my head.
Okay, we'll send it to you. It's on YouTube, and I went and looked it up today because I was thinking about some, you know, memorable catches near a wall like that. It's insane.
It's a really incredible catch. He's been talking about it all morning. Ian, who was it for you defensively? Like, so who were the great catchers of the baseball in the outfield that you were like, man, one of these days, I hope I can do that?
Yeah, honestly, I grew up as a shortstop and always wanted to be an infielder, always wanted to be a shortstop, and then played infield in the big league. So, you know, for me, it was Omar Vizquel and, you know, just the really great shortstop play, you know, Jeter jump throws. And, you know, that was the stuff when I was growing up that I would watch.
So like A-Rod, Nomar, Jeter.
Yeah, like all of those guys who were playing defense at the top of the
Tejada.
Game. Yeah. And so I was always, you know, Khalil Green, that was he was playing fantastic defense, Tulowitzki, you know, those were the guys that I was watching growing up, and you know, loving watching double play turns and great defensive shortstop play. So, you know, but there was also, you know, Andrew Jones and Torrey Hunter running around out there, those guys, and Alex Gordon, honestly, you know, the way that he played left field, just you know, always a lot of respect for that. But when I was growing up, it was more about shortstop infield play.
You ever revisit some of those youth fields when you're in Pittsburgh?
Not in a couple years, but I definitely have. You know, it's really cool to go back the high school field. The high school field that I played at, interestingly enough, was all dirt infield. And in Pittsburgh, there wasn't a ton of grass infields. There was only a few. And so we had all dirt. And our head coach worked tirelessly to keep that thing in good shape. But you would get a lot of bad hops out there and a lot of balls. There's a lot of blood on that field from guys wearing balls off the face in the summer working on infield defense. And so it's all turf now. And my brother and I constantly remind our high school head coach that those kids now are soft and they don't have to deal with the bad hops. And, you know, we used to take ground balls on the parking lot next to the field in the winter, and there would be salt all over it. And so you'd be getting bad hops from salt on asphalt. And it's a little bit different now with the all turf field, but it is cool to go back and see it.
Yeah, that should be the name of like the 30 for 30, blood on the fields. Yeah. When you go back and do the documentary on it. I would imagine that you guys, as the season has gone on, like there have been a lot of nights where you guys have struggled to score runs. That a night like last night is super cathartic for everyone.
Yeah, and I think, you know, two nights ago in Miami, three nights ago now, I mean, we scored a bunch of runs. You know, we've had some games like that lately. I think the offense as a whole, when you look at a game like last night, you know, Pete getting on base three times, you got Amaya doing what he's doing. I think it was five hits last night. And then Dansby, it's a grand slam. You know, when the offense is clicking like that, everybody top to bottom is contributing. You know, it's really a lot of fun. You know, you're always going to have those. I was the guy when we scored a bunch of runs the other night who went 0-for-4. But you have, when top to bottom, the offense is producing and everybody's getting in the act, that's a ton of fun.
I want to throw some numbers your way since you brought it up, Ian. I looked at the numbers for PCA. PCA is really coming along offensively. Over the last 7 days, slashing 360, 448, 680. Over the last 15 days, 306, 382, 633. Over the last 30 days, 283, 336, 515. Amaya made that mechanical change in his swing. Amaya, over the last seven, 500, 538, 875, last 15, 360, 396, 640, last 30, 341, 389, 580, with five home runs and 19 RBIs for Miguel Amaya. Ian, how hard is it for a player like Amaya? And I know that he had dabbled with the way that he's swinging before, but for a player to change and be given the opportunity in a season to take a couple days to go work on something, how rare is it that something like that even works?
Yeah, in-season adjustments are really hard. We actually just did the podcast last night and kind of went into depth on this. But Amaya's always had really high bat speed numbers. He's a strong dude, swings the bat hard. And so for him, going to the foot down early move made a lot of sense because he doesn't need the extra bats. He doesn't need extra momentum in his swing. He already has it. And so for him to get his foot down, be able to see the ball, make really good swing decisions, and puts his move is really clean. But when he gets into a place where he's overstriding or putting his body in a bad spot and not being on time, is really challenging. And so for him, with the foot down, the move is so clean that everything kind of syncs up and works a lot better. He's got the juice. You can see it with the home run numbers, pull side home runs. And so it's been awesome to watch. It's been awesome. I know he was working really hard on it. And for the first, you know, what, 3-4 months of the season, working really hard on some of those changes and just not getting the one to click. And so for him to find the one that's clicked and been really productive. It's awesome to see. He handles the pitching staff great. He's super positive and upbeat and a great teammate. And so to watch offensive success, and then for PCA, you know, just the ability to get his swing into a better spot where he's more on time, he's up earlier, he's seeing the ball better and making good swing decisions. So he's not working from behind in counts continuously. He's getting into his leverage counts where he can actually take some chances and get pitches to hit. When you're playing in this league and you're 0-1, 0-2 all the time, it's really challenging. You just look at the league numbers in those counts and they're horrible. And so when you can get into those situations where you're spitting on the bad pitches early and getting yourself into those leverage counts, you know, you see the difference, and it's been awesome.
He's so bouncy on the bases. Like, it's one thing to take a lead or lean a certain direction. He's like boing, 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 like Qbert out there. Is that just, is that his style, or is that something that over time just sort of the that excess electricity kind of wears off?
No, I think part of it's his athleticism. Part of it's his confidence. You know, he's the fastest guy in the field, and he's got confidence that he's going to get that bag every single time. And so it's been fun to watch. I mean, his ability to run the bases is pretty special. And just there's guys like a Trey Turner and like Pete who they're up to speed instantly. Like as soon as they hit go, they're, you know, two steps and they're at their top speed. And that's what it looks like from him. You know, at the top end, he's flying. He's one of the fastest guys in the league, but he gets there so quick. And I think that's the difference between the elite base runners.
It wouldn't take a grizzled baseball observer to understand that the scouting report last night was run whenever you think you got a chance to steal a base. And I know even when, you know, you stole second and then he tried the old pump fake, oh, I'm going to get you. And even the rookie was like, yeah, okay, whatever. And didn't bite on that at all. What did it actually say in your scouting report about the opposing catcher?
I mean, we had a lot of bags, you know, a bunch of different bags. So, you know, I stole early on a 3-2 count. On a curveball in the dirt. You know, it was a situation where 3-2, trusting that Say is going to put the ball in play if it's a fastball, and, you know, being able to get that bag on a slider in the dirt. And then we had some first and third situations where, you know, if Pete's a really fast runner on third base, are they going to risk throwing through with the opportunity for Pete to then take the backside bag and score. And so we had a few of those bags. We had a couple of really good jumps from guys on second base, on some one looks or some higher times. And so just, and then you have Pete who, you know, his ability to steal second base, even on a guy that has a quicker time to home. So it was a bunch of different stuff. I wouldn't say it was one thing specifically, but guys did a really good job being aggressive on the base paths and putting pressure on them. And when you have guys that you're getting on first base and it's turning into a double, it just, you could see last night how it kind of propels the offense. And even through the first three or four innings of that game, you know, we had a bunch of opportunities to score more runs and didn't take advantage of it. So to be able to continue to put the pressure on and continue to add to that lead was huge.
So what's the next step for this Cubs team? I mean, I know, are you going into cliche mode here? Because it does seem like it's time for that, Ian, where it is just one game at a time.
Yeah, it's one game, one series. I think, you know, I saw some stuff after the Marlins series about not being able to finish series, and we had one, I think, at home where we had a chance to sweep. You know, if you lose the second game of that series and you win the final game and you win the series, you know, I don't know if it's the same narrative. And so for us, it's being able to continue to play good baseball, continue to win series, and just stack those on top of each other. This is the big leagues. This is the highest level in the world. It's not easy to sweep teams. It's not easy to win three games in a row. You know, you've seen it from us all year, even when we were struggling in the middle of the year and not putting up runs and having a tough time. You know, we weren't getting swept. It's hard to sweep in the big leagues. It's really challenging. And so just to keep playing good baseball, we you know, we lose that game in Miami, the last game of the series, and we bounce back and put up a bunch of runs yesterday and run away with one. So keep doing that. Keep building the momentum and just taking it one game, one series at a time.
Was PCA's Inside the Park home run the fastest you've ever seen in person?
Yeah, I think so. I can't think of another one that was any quicker than that. It was like the second fastest in the last 10 years or something.
Yeah, I think Buxton, I want to say Byron Buxton was the only guy who was under 14 seconds.
That guy can fly.
But what I have to do is I have to go back in time.
Oh, Lord.
What? Willie Wilson, 1979 against the Yankees. Somebody's got to get a stopwatch. I've got it somewhere, but I thought that was the fastest I'd ever, I wasn't in person, but it was the fastest I've ever seen on television. So, but PCA, it was close to that, man. Because that, you're right.
Yeah, that was a scary send too. Nobody out, and Willie sends him there. He did a great job of keeping up the pace at scoring. But just, you know, for him with that speed, you know, if an outfielder misplays a ball, hits off the wall, and the outfielder takes an extra step the wrong way. I mean, it's amazing. He turns doubles into triples, and in that case, triple into a homer.
All right, so you got Paul Skeens coming up again. You've faced him once, and you're more ready for him?
Faced him twice already, actually.
You faced twice? Okay.
We got his first two. So, yeah, I think a little bit more information out there now after he's had, you know, a number of starts in the big league. So we'll have a plan going into it. He's got good stuff. He's obviously been really good in his first, whatever it is, 15 starts or so. And, you know, we'll have a little bit more information going into this one than we did after his first one or two starts. So it'll be a good challenge. And, you know, we're focused on tonight and getting to win tonight and then being able to deal with that last game of the series.
All right, go get them. And people should know Connect Roasters and Patio Blend and everything else. Here's to more Dinger Dollars.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
That is Ian Happ of the Chicago Cubs. We've got High Noon coming up next. The Pacific is leading the Atlantic in what? You have to tell me.
I have a fake athlete that forgot they were a fake athlete.
Bernstein and Holmes. Middays 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
I'll be back this way on Monday. We'll settle this then. Right there, out in the street, in front of the Palace Saloon.
Yeah, right. When? High Noon?
It's High Noon. I'm going to save mine. I'm going to let you do yours. We talk Bears. We've been following the roster cuts, and we did a Cubs quiz, and we're questioning the actual depth of the Bears roster, and we talked to Ian Happ.
It's High Noon. Any man, and especially any black man of a certain age, has a crush on Sanaa Lathan. One of my favorite movies is Love and Basket. She should be in your algorithm, by the way.
Wasn't she with... Was that with the one Adewale Ogunleye dated?
Yes. So, she was in Love and Basketball, which is a lot of people's favorite basketball movie.
I know it was mine. I was, like, in junior high when that came out.
It's
so,
a fun,
you know,
movie. Mike Tomlin did a great job in that movie. I was... impressed with his basketball skills. Dennis Haysbert is also in that movie as well. And so Sanaa, that movie was kind of a seminal moment for the WNBA at the beginning of the WNBA. And she explained how it all kind of came about and forgot that she was a Los Angeles Spark.
It's so funny because Love and Basketball was so long ago that I forgot that I was a Spark. I forgot. And so we get there, and I knew people, you know, because of the Love and Basketball, I knew we would get attention, but it was like crazy. And then the next day, all of the memes, it brought me back to when we were actually shooting. When she wrote Love and Basketball, there was no WNBA. So Monica, my character, says, I'm going to be the first girl in the NBA.
Uh-huh.
So she says that. But by the time she got the deal and we were shooting, WNBA was 1 year old.
Oh, my gosh.
And so she got this amazing opportunity to shoot the last scene of the movie when Monica's checking into the game at a real game.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's really great. RuPaul hosting the Jimmy Kimmel show, by the way. It was Sanaa told that story. But.
And yeah, you're right. How is she not in the algorithm?
She's flawless. Yeah. Facts. So, that was. It's always nice to see anything that has Sanaa Lathan in it.
I wonder, she got a Yale MFA. I wonder.
Uh-oh, that means now she's legit to Dan.
No, no, no. I'm just thinking that that whole. How old is Lupita Nyong'o?
She's a lot younger than Sanaa.
Yeah, way younger, right? Because I know that Lupita Nyong'o and I think Winston Duke were in the Yale acting program at the same time.
Yeah, Lupita's 41.
Okay, all right. I'm just curious. So, and she's way younger than Meryl Streep, who was also there with...
They weren't all there together, no.
John Cazale? I don't know. But it was. I'm just curious what kind of class that
but
was.
But Sanaa was probably there with Theo, right? Isn't that about the same age?
Yeah.
That is High Noon. We do it every day around this time. Brian Baldinger is going to talk to us about the Bears, and we can ask him some of the questions about depth next here on The Score.